This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello and welcome to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Bill McCush. This week, Rhonda Crawford talks about her late father, Carl Campy Crawford, a police officer who was known for his kindness, compassion, and going way above the call of duty. We'll talk to a local psychiatrist about her collection of short stories that shine a light on the struggles of mental health. And the Highland Arts Theatre is announcing a playwriting award in honor of one of Cape Breton's most esteemed poets, Rita Joe. All of this coming up on Dialogue, the Coast 89.7. When Carl Campy Crawford of Whitney Pier joined the Sydney Police Service in 1964, he became the first black municipal police officer east of Montreal. But his family says his reputation while patrolling the streets of Sydney is his real legacy. The municipality paid tribute to Crawford recently, naming the so-called Road to Nowhere in Sydney as Crawford Crossing. He died in 2003 at the age of 64. We spoke to his daughter Rhonda about the street naming.
Well, Carl Campy Crawford, my father, he was a very special person to many people. He was someone who truly believed in community. He worked in the community. He did many things for the youth. He always had time for the youth, which is so important. And today when I hear people who grew up with me, my age, and who knew my father, they tell me stories about when he would just stop. And when he was in the police car, he would stop and he would just chat. You know, many times youth might think that, you know, when the police officer approaches, it has to do with negative things. But my father always wanted to make sure that the youth knew that the police were someone that they could relate to, that they could talk to. They were having challenges, that they were there to support them also.
And he had a reputation, of course, like you said, there as a standout in the way he dealt with people, being a police officer. And there was a story that your mother, Iris, told about encountering people who would be intoxicated on the street, and still he treated those people with great respect. Do you know of that particular story I'm referring to there?
Well, I think there's probably many. You know, when my father passed away, there were so many people that talked about my father giving them a chance, and they said that they felt that sometimes the conversations they had with my father was more of a deterrent to never do it again rather than facing the criminal justice system. And they talked about, you know, if they would have had to go through the criminal justice system, they could have possibly lost their employment, which would have been detrimental to their families. One of the things my father always used to tell us is no matter what someone has done, there's always something good in that person, and you really need to look to make sure you're finding the good in each person. And, you know, we never know what someone else had to deal with in their past. It's always important that we not judge people and that we, as I say, look for the good in each person.
I certainly hope it doesn't put you on the spot to refer to that particular story. If I can just elaborate on it for a moment, that he encountered an intoxicated gentleman. The family was struggling with money, and instead of taking him to jail or writing a ticket, he actually took the gentleman to his home and actually put him in bed.
Yes. So many people are so quick to judge people and not lend a helping hand. And this was a way my father could be doing his job in ensuring that a citizen of the city of Sydney, who was having some challenges at the time, got some help. And, you know, we didn't, at the time when all of that was happening, there weren't so many resources as we have today. And, you know, it's just one of those things that it makes me feel really good to know that many people can share stories of the good that my father did in the community. And, you know, each day I think we hear a different one about my father, and I think it's something that I strive to ensure that I instill some of those same things in my children, and that I hope that others look out for their fellow man or fellow woman and give somebody who's down, give them a helping hand, and that makes our community stronger.
Many other stories, too. One about a student on their way to school, and Mr. Crawford had noticed something about their clothing, and he ended up buying them a pair of shoes. Would you care to share that story with us?
Well, I think, you know, that particular story, I'm not sure, but, you know, that there's many times that my father would say, you know, someone didn't have something, and he made sure he did get it. You know, there was a story of a woman who had told us that she had lost a family member and a parent and was on Charlotte Street and needed a black dress, and all the stores were closed by the time the woman got there, and my father happened to be working the beat on Charlotte Street, he knocked on the door of one of the stores, and the owner of the store came and let the woman go in after hours and get her dress that she needed. He saw someone in need. He knew he had some influence that he could help the woman out, and he did that, and that's the type of person that he was.
Father had a unique nickname as well, Campy, and that's a reference to an athlete from the 1950s and 60s, the Brooklyn Dodgers. How did your father get his nickname, Campy?
Well, there was a number of people in the community, a number of youth in the community at the time, who, when the Negro League started and they had all the teams, my father and some of his friends, when they'd play baseball, they each took on various nicknames. A good friend of my father, his nickname was Satch, after Satchel Paige. My father was after Roy Campanella. And so they all took on those because they admired black athletes who were playing the caliber of baseball that they were. And, you know, they saw them as inspiration. So and those names stuck with them. So many of them, that's the names that we know. Some of them we may not even know what their real name is because they were always referred to by their nickname.
And the friends your father met when he played baseball as a young person, he remained friends up until his passing, is that right?
Oh, definitely. Yes, definitely. And, you know, that's the camaraderie that was in the community, and that's the camaraderie that happened in sports. And, you know, with the naming of the street, you know, we hear from people that, you know, have moved away from the community and, you know, want to share their stories about my father.
Do you know the story about how your father became interested in policing?
Yes. Well, I don't know if it was even really an interest. My father was working on the rail on the railway. He joined the railway in as a porter. And then when they found out that he had high school, he was moved to another part of the train and new responsibilities of ensuring that supplies and all of the linens and everything were on each of the trains. That took him away from the family. I mean, he was on a route that was out of Halifax, went to Montreal, and so he was away from his family. He had, at the time, he had two children, my brother Carl and my sister Cheryl. And Tom Miller, who was alderman at the time, they were looking at trying to recruit new police officers, and Tom recognized that there was a gap in our community, that there was no blacks on the police force. So it wasn't really a force that represented the community because it lacked that diversity. And Tom Miller advocated for giving my father a chance. He knew my father had a young family, and he was being taken away from his family to work away. And fortunately, my father, you know, took on that challenge, and, you know, he was... I think Tom was proud of the police officer my father was, and I know we as a family are very proud of my father.
When you hear of people being mistreated by the police, whether it's, you know, here or anywhere else around the world, do you think of your father's reputation and wonder how he would have handled a situation like that?
Well, you know what, my father was someone who never talked about necessarily, he didn't talk about his work to us. So some of those feelings he would have probably kept to himself, but I think my father would have been very frustrated because that's not, you know, my father didn't believe in intimidation. He didn't believe in mistreating people. He didn't believe in profiling. He didn't believe in treating someone differently because of their socioeconomic backgrounds or the color of their skin or their religion or their sexual orientation. He believed that, fairness and equality for all, and you treat people with respect, and that way you gain respect.
There's the popular photo of Mr. Crawford, and your mom has it proudly displayed in her home. There's something very professional and dignified about it. Can you tell me about that picture, please?
Oh, the policing picture of my father's police picture. My father was, we used to say he was one of the best dressed police officers. He was very particular. His shoes were always shined. His uniform was always pressed. He was His hair was always cut short. There was a professionalism. When he put that uniform on, he respected the uniform. And I think that, you know, how his comportment and everything was, that showed people in the community that, you know, he took his job seriously. You know, he had a way with people. He had a good sense of humor. But he was very serious and very professional as a police officer.
He loved to sing. What do you remember about this, and what was his favorite kind of music?
Oh, my father. My father sang all the time. He loved music. He loved, you know, the old music, as we call them, the music of his time. He loved music of the Caribbean. He loved his spirituals. He was a member of the Inspirational Singers, one of the original members of the Inspirational Singers. And, you know, it was something that he loved to do. When you saw my father singing in the choir, everybody used to say, you know what, he always looks like he's having such a good time when he's there singing in with the Inspirational Singers. He also sang in a group. They were called the Etzels. He and some of his friends, and they used to sing the songs of the 60s and 50s and 60s, and they loved singing, and he loved singing.
Do you see any of your children or any of your mom's grandchildren a desire to work in policing because of your dad?
Well, I don't know for the, you know, the grandchildren are quite young right now. But my son, he always said he wanted to be a police officer. He actually had his own little uniform. He had the opportunity to go to the police station and spend some time with Chief McIsaac, and it was something that he was interested in. And whether or not he does continues on with that, but the fact is the qualities of fairness and respect and treating people fairly, those are the things that are going to be so important when they grow up.
What was he like as a father, policing aside and community leader activities? Just as a dad, what was Mr. Crawford like?
My father was, you know, he was someone that we could sit and we could laugh with. He had a good sense of humor, but, you know, he, as I said, he was one that always made sure that we knew our beginnings and we knew about our heritage. You know, his father was from originally from Barbados, you know, bringing some of that culture into our home. And also, he was one that always welcomed our friends into the home, you know, wanted to make sure that we and our friends were safe in the community. And he was, you know, we miss him. We miss him. He was very wise. He gave good advice. And, you know, those conversations are something that I miss.
I was wondering if you could talk about the Sydney-Toronto family reunion, and the previous one being in 2015, of course, this year being a challenge in so many ways because of COVID. Will that be an ongoing tradition as well?
Well, the Sydney-Toronto reunion started in 1985 when a group of former residents and also with St. Philip's Church wanted to organize something and bring people back home. And then back in 1985, there was the train, so they had arranged. There were a number of people from the community, the black community, that used to work on the trains. They arranged, you know, cars on the trains for people to get from Toronto to Sydney, and they picked people up all along the way. And then it was that every 5 years they would have the reunion, and there was an organization that was called the Sydney-Toronto Organization, based out of Toronto, and they had events, you know, throughout the year, and then the reunions. And, you know, as the community started to dwindle and some of the elders of the community who were the organizers and all of this, then it was, we were noticing we were losing people too fast, and we wanted to, you know, bring the reunions closer. So some of them got shortened, and, you know, it might have been 2 years, and so it was canceled. There were people that wanted to organize it for last summer, but with COVID, it was canceled. And, you know, people are hopeful for July or August of this year, but COVID will determine whether or not that materializes. But I think it's something that's in the forefront of people's minds, because many of our elders are you know, we're losing them, and we want to have them, we want to learn from them and have the opportunity to see people. And it's one of the things that, you know, our community was a strong community, and we want to make sure that those that had to move away always know that this is their home.
And your father recently received a rare tribute that only a few community leaders get to have, and that's having a street named after them. So when you're driving around town, or you're down close to your home, how do you feel when you see this new street sign that says Crawford Crossing?
Well, I can tell you, the first time I drove on that, on the street, I felt proud. Sad in a way also. I take my father being here over a street any day. But it makes my heart feel full to know that when people see this, the name of the street, they'll think of my father. You know, there's a generation of children. For example, my children didn't have the opportunity to meet my father. He had passed away before they were born. And but children are learning about my father. They're seeing his picture. They're hearing conversations about him, and that, again, is another generation that when they hear his name, they'll remember him, and that to me is so important to us as a family.
And another tribute to your father, which is the Campy Crawford Annual Award. That's an annual presentation through the regional police. Can you talk a little bit about that, and is the family involved, and what kind of people are recognized through this award?
Well, this is an award that was put forward. It was a combination of the Human Rights Commission, Cape Breton University, and the municipality with the police service. And it was a way of recognizing his contribution to the community. But it also, for those that, you know, are recipients of the award, they look for things, you know, fairness, equality, sportsmanship, all of those things that are positive attributes of a person and their contribution to their communities.
On The Good Sentence, Paul McDougall talks to local writer and psychiatrist Dr. Julie Kerwin about her first collection of short stories, the title, The Appendage Formerly Known as Your Left Arm. Her stories deal with the struggles people have with various mental health problems in a heartfelt and sometimes humorous way. Kerwin also talks about the mental health effects COVID-19 has on people in the local area.
Okay, so Julie, your book, The Appendage Formerly Known as Your Left Arm, is a collection of short stories. I know you've been working on these for a while, correct?
I started writing short stories in, I'd say about a little over 10 years ago, maybe 12 years ago. I signed up for a workshop with Douglas Arthur Brown. It was sort of an introductory writing workshop, and started writing some short stories then, and I've been kind of very slowly writing a couple every year, and so it's taken probably about more than 10 years, I think, to put this whole book together. And where the ideas come from, all over the place. So sometimes they come from sort of an amalgam of different people that I've met. Sometimes they come from just a sentence that pops into my head, or a what-if kind of question. And in some cases, they might be things that I've read about and found interesting, or in other you know, there's one story that deals with post-traumatic stress disorder, although I don't think it actually mentions that by name, but it's a story called Watchmen. It's about a soldier, former soldier, who's dealing with PTSD. So that one, for example, it's not based on any individual with PTSD, but it's based on having worked with, you know, dozens, if not hundreds, of soldiers or former soldiers with PTSD. So just, I guess it's based on what I know about that disorder, but not on any one individual.
Your recurring psychiatrist person is interesting. Now, we know it's not you, though. Her name is Julie, right?
Julia.
Okay. Julia. You're changing in a vowel, and you got a whole other person. But she's in some of the stories. And why don't we, and that's the title of the book, The Appendage Formerly Known as Your Left Arm. Why don't you just set the stage for that story?
Yeah, well, the name of the book comes from the title of that story, The Appendage Formerly Known as Your Left Arm, and the premise of that story is this woman who happens to be the psychiatrist, Dr. Julia Bernstein Stankoff. She sort of wakes up one morning and feels like her left arm is not her own, and it starts getting heavier and heavier, and she decides she wants to have it amputated because it's not her arm. And, you know, obviously goes to many doctors, has many tests done, and they're all telling her, you know, there's nothing wrong with that arm, but she feels as if it doesn't belong to her. If you read the book carefully, the character in the story before that one is a little girl named Julia, although it's not entirely clear that it's the same Julia, who is abused as a child, and there is an incident involving a left arm in that story. So I deliberately sort of made it a little bit vague, but if you want to, you could make the connection between that little girl and the issue with the left arm in that story, and then this adult woman who can't really deal with her own painful emotions, her husband's just left her, etc. You know, she has a problem with her left arm, so it goes on a quest to have her perfectly good left arm amputated.
Do you recommend people that they read the stories in the order, so if there's a little nuances and things like that in the book, they will maybe pick up on?
Yeah, they all stand alone as individual short stories, but if you read them in order, you may find little connections and recurring characters. So I would recommend reading them in order for that reason.
So let's just talk a little bit about that problem, because that, or issue, I don't know what the term it is you would call it, but that concept, I'm familiar with it. I read about it a number of years ago, this notion that part of me, and it's usually an arm or a leg or something, doesn't belong. There's something wrong with it. It's a mental thing. It's in your head. To you, it's real, but physically, there's no problem. How prevalent is this kind of thing? And have you ever come across a case where someone had this actual issue?
No. In my professional life, I've never come across anyone with this. I think it's fairly rare, but I have read about it. And when I read about it, I read an article about it, and I was quite fascinated with this condition where, someone, sometimes from a very early age, feels as if usually one of their limbs is not their own, and they want it taken off. And in some cases, they do have it amputated. But I've never seen it professionally. I think it's fairly rare, but it is fascinating.
From sort of how I understand it, people will fabricate another reason for the actual amputation and try to convince someone to do it, or maybe go to some country where somebody will do it. Or
I've in the article that I read, they talked about people who would deliberately cut off the circulation to that limb, so then it would have to be amputated, or they would, you know, freeze it in liquid nitrogen or something, so then, you know, then the surgeons would have to take it off. But or in some cases, they'll find, you know, an unscrupulous surgeon that will do it. I guess you could argue about that ethically, but in this case, you know, the story is about her sort of funny quest to have it amputated.
Mm-hmm. A lot of the stories in the book, actually, I find there's quite a bit of hope in them, and there is humor in them, and there's a thing about people that have problems or issues, but they learn, they're living with them, and it's not the end of the world for them. And the story Entanglement, I really like this. This is an older woman, and she gave her son up when she was 47 years ago, a baby that was born, and so 47 years later. So we're talking about someone that's probably 70 or something. And she's trying, she feels she's getting messages now from the son, and she can find the son and reconnect with the son, which she does and she doesn't, but there's something nice about that story. Do you want to talk a bit about that?
Yeah, so in that story, it's a woman who is probably, she's a patient of our recurring psychiatrist, and she probably has psychosis. It's never clearly stated. She might have schizophrenia or something like that, but she is haunted by this memory of the baby that she gave up when she was 19 years old or something, and now she's getting older, and she starts getting what she thinks are messages about where she can find the the lost son, in basically her flyers that come in the mail. So she will get a pizza flyer that says 2 for 1, and she thinks that there's some special significance to that, etc. So she goes on a quest to find her lost son, and she finds a son, but I won't spoil it.
No.
By giving away the all the details, but yeah, it's so again, you know, I think the stories that I like to read are stories that can simultaneously make me laugh and cry. So I aim for the same thing in my writing. I try to get to tell a story that's humorous, but at the same time, you know, doesn't lack compassion.
Mm-hmm. The opening story in the book, Jarvis, I've heard you read this once or twice over the years at writer events that we've both been at or something, and it's the four people traveling to Cape Breton for the funeral of a mother of one of the other ones, but the four people in the car all have their own issues, but it's like, it's a pretty humorous story, and you can see how they sort of become a family unto their own. They're not related, but their problems have brought them together like that, and so in one sense they are a family, and they all have different issues, but they're all willing to step up to get the other one back home to Cape Breton in time for the funeral of the mother, of which she didn't really even like her mother.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And again, I think that's probably the best example of what I'm talking about. When I have read that story to a room full of people, they're laughing out loud by the end of it, and yet it deals with things like suicide and abuse and some pretty dark themes, mental illness and suicide and all that. But and yet, when I read that story, people are laughing out loud, and it's hard to explain, you know, how that works, because I, you know, obviously don't want to make light of those issues or laugh at people who are suffering. But like I said, the stories that I enjoy reading are the ones that are touching and compassionate, but also have an element of humor to them.
Yeah,
so that's what I aim for in my writing.
There's another one I want to ask you about is group therapy, and so one person leans to the other and says, "Here is a secret." The drugs don't work. So just talk a little bit about that, the mix between, in psychiatry, between, you know, things like that, talk therapy and that, versus drugs and medications, and what are the roles of each?
Well, you know, it's a difficult issue. I could talk all day about that, but, you know, my own personal view of my profession is that there is a tendency to rely too much on medication and not enough on, you know, the other aspects of treatment and life in general. So it's actually the psychiatrist, who again is not me, but it's actually the psychiatrist narrator who says that.
Yes, that's right.
And you know, I think she's just expressing her frustration with she gives out these drugs, but she doesn't know how to heal the souls of the people that she's dealing with, including her own. So, yeah, I mean, I have my... certainly not implying that psychiatric medications aren't useful at times and that they don't work, but I do think there's a tendency in the modern materialist age to over-rely on medications and not look at, you know, what's going on in a person's soul, if you will. So that's what she's kind of expressing, that frustration, mm-hmm. in that story as the narrator.
Mm-hmm. Let's just talk a little bit about what's going on today in the world, you know, with the pandemic, and how are you dealing with some of this and trying to help people through it? Do you want to just tell us, just in general, some little thoughts that you have on it?
Absolutely. You know, I am noticing that people are really struggling with their mental health, and it's not just me. I read a study the other day, which was published in the JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, showing that rates of depression in the U.S., and I'm sure it's similar in Canada, have risen threefold since the start of the pandemic. That's rates of depressive symptomatology. So, you know, people reporting symptoms of depression, they're reporting three times as many symptoms of depression as they were at a comparable time the year before. So, you know, it definitely seems to be impacting mental health, and it's in various ways. I think, you know, some people, if you have someone who has obsessive compulsive tendencies, worrying about germs, you know, they're worried about the actual virus. A lot of my soldiers with PTSD get very nervous when everyone around them is wearing a mask because of their hypervigilance and so on. So they're finding it hard to go out because people wearing masks are very difficult for them to be around. But I think the biggest factors are, you know, the economic uncertainty, unemployment for a lot of people, the loneliness. A lot of elderly people are really struggling with being more socially isolated, not doing as many group activities and that sort of thing. So, you know, in different ways, I think it's taken a toll on almost everybody in terms of their psychological health.
The good news, of course, in the recent weeks is the vaccine. So there is some hope coming for sure. So we're looking for a brighter 2021, probably midway through the year.
Yeah.
So you feel good about all that?
I do. Yeah, I'm hopeful. I mean, I think it's going to take at least several months to you know, get the vaccines approved and distributed. And hopefully, you know, they'll come up with some kind of system to prioritize who gets it, and so that all of us can get back to a more normal way of doing things. But, 2020 has been a tough year, hasn't it?
Yeah, it certainly has. So your book was published by Bulgey Iron Press, and it's available. Where is it available?
It's available at the, every Saturday at the Cape Breton Farmers Market until Christmas, and at the Cape Breton Farmers Market store. There's a little store there at the site of the Farmers Market downtown. It's available directly from Bulger Island Press or on Amazon.ca.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also available at a number of different local bookstores. I believe it's at Chapters in the Mayflower Mall and a lot of, you know, smaller local bookstores as well.
Yep. Okay, so that's great. So that's The Appendage, formerly known as Your Arm, and Other Stories. There's about a dozen short stories in it. I, as a reader and occasional writer myself, I really, really enjoyed it, so congratulations on it. So, Julie Kerwin, writer, and Dr. Julie Kerwin, psychiatrist, how about leaving us with one good sentence from the book?
Okay, I'll read you the first sentence from the title story, The Appendage Formerly Known as Your Left Arm. Here is your dilemma. You have a piece of meat attached to your shoulder where your left arm used to be.
The Highland Arts Theatre in Sydney is reaching out to writers and playwrights across the country to submit a proposal for a play. The winner gets $10,000. It's for people who identify as Black, Indigenous, or as a person of color. The theatre's executive and artistic director, Wesley Colford, spoke to Dialogue's Dave DeVoe about the Rita Jo Canadian Playwriting Award.
This is something that I think 2020 really shone a light on for everybody from every industry, of just the continued social inequities that continue to plague us even today, which unfortunately is especially the case in the performing arts and in theater, which has such a long history, at least in Western theater, of being predominantly Anglo-Saxon. So historically, a lot of the leadership positions, a lot of the performers that you see on stage, even, you know, in movies and TV shows, predominantly have been Caucasian, and certainly none of us have anything against Caucasian performers, but it's important as we look at the current spectrum and what Canada looks like, and in fact what Cape Breton looks like. We want to be representative of all of the different people, all the different heritages, all the different cultures, and that's something that starts with leadership and ultimately starts with play selection. And part of the problem is, if you look at, I don't know, a couple thousand years of Western theater and scripts being written, almost all of the scripts that we consider canon were written by white people. That's just unfortunately part of the history. We have obviously so many historical scripts, dramas, comedies, starting in ancient Greece, obviously France and especially the United Kingdom were huge contributors. But again, looking at what Canada looks like, that's not necessarily representative. So when we started thinking about ways that we can help this community that's been so underrepresented, obviously there's lots of things we're doing and lots of things we're continuing to do, but a real gap that we noticed was this, percentage-wise, a significant proportion, significantly lower proportion of plays that are written by Black, Indigenous, or playwrights of color. So that's where the idea started, and we wanted to make sure it wasn't just something that felt superficial. We wanted it to be a meaningful change, and as a playwright myself, I thought about what would be the most beneficial if someone was to create something like this that was to benefit me, and we talked to a lot of people, we did a lot of consulting, and at the end of the day, being able to provide someone with the means that for a period of time, they don't have to worry about paying their bills, they don't have to worry about managing five or six different part-time jobs, they can just focus and write a brand new script, and that we'd be able to provide resources beyond just monetary, but to support, to help with the development. Hopefully, it's something that's going to make a real impact. And certainly, the intention of the design was to create what I would have seen as sort of the perfect situation if someone was trying to help me write a new play.
So I know you're among the judges. Who else is among the judges in the contest?
Sure. So we have a fantastic panel of three people who will read the submissions and then ultimately work together to come up with our first winner. Like you said, I'm one of them, of course. And for me, one of the joys is not just that we're going to have a winner who will support, but I'm actually so excited just to be able to read all the submissions and get to be introduced to the work of so many playwrights from across the country that maybe I haven't heard of before, or maybe I have, but not, I'm not aware of a new project they're working on or whatever the case might be. So I'm really looking forward to my participation. I think it's going to have all kinds of additional benefits for all of the playwrights and for us certainly as well. The second member is Robin Lee Seal, who's been the project coordinator for our Tell Your Story initiative, which has been running for the past, year and a half. And she's also been an assistant director for us. She's certainly a well-known performer. She's acted in many of our productions. And so she's one of the people, actually, that we originally came up with the concept with. So I'm thrilled to have her involved. And then thirdly, I would consider this more of, a guest panelist. We have the fantastic Marcia Johnson, who is a playwright, an actor, a director, all-around theater guru. She actually taught me when I was in theater school at Sheridan College about 10 years ago, and she is going to be our third panelist. So she's Toronto-based, and we're just so thrilled to have her involved as well.
So what is it that you three are going to be looking for as you go through all of the entries?
At the end of the day, what we're really trying to do is make sure everyone hopefully feels as open and comfortable to really propose whatever project they are most excited about, most passionate about, whatever captures the imagination, and again, is a project that they wouldn't be able to do without the support. So we're not
genre-specific or anything like that?
No. We really tried to be as open as possible, because at the end of the day, I feel like the integrity of the entire project is compromised if I was to say, we're looking for a brand new play from a BIPOC artist, but it has to be two actors, and it has to be 90 minutes long, and it has to be about the Civil War,
Yeah.
That's really not the point. The whole point is to give freedom and both expression and acknowledgement to these amazing voices that are out there in whatever form their creativity takes them. So
yeah.
Obviously, there's going to be a bias at the end of the day because we're the ones that are going to choose what makes us most excited, but that's why we have three panelists. Hopefully there's a nice diversity of backgrounds and experiences to help make those decisions. And it's really up to the applicants then to sell us on their idea and to pitch whatever it is. So, it could be a Afrofuturistic sci-fi opera, or it could be a very domestic one-person show about their experience working at a Pepsi store. I mean, honestly, anything in the gambit of human experience.
Now, I understand the money for this prize comes from the money you got through your Radical Access project. For those who don't know, just say a little bit about that project and how it produced the prize money that you're giving out.
Absolutely. So back in June 2020, we were in quite a dire state. Obviously, the pandemic had ravaged not just us, but almost every industry and business, and especially venues and you know, all of the industry connected to the performing arts. We'd been closed down for 3 or 4 months at that point. There wasn't a whole lot of hope in sight, and we were very realistically looking at bankruptcy, which is not something any of us wanted to see happen. So what we, over a great deal of work with our entire team, what we came up with was a new program called Radical Access. And if you haven't heard about it, you can certainly go on our website to get more information. Basically, it's a new form of, I guess, a funding model, you could call it, that instead of relying primarily on ticket sales, which is what had happened for our entire history, we were asking the community to make a charitable donation every month for $25 or more or $5 or whatever people could afford, but some monthly commitment. And if we were able to get to various goals, we would commit to varying projects and initiatives, which, again, you can look up. There's a whole lot of things that we committed to. The I guess the sort of prime objective was to reach our 100% goal, which would be monthly donations of $50,000 a month, which represents about half of our budget. If we reached that goal, we said we would commit to all 12 main stage productions of plays and musicals being absolutely free for the entire community. So it basically guaranteed we had the ongoing revenue to actually pay our bills, pay for these productions, pay for the heat, the lighting, all the huge expenses that having a 400-seat venue entails. And as a result, we wouldn't be relying on the ticket sales for those specific shows. So they would be free for people to donate. They'd be free for people in the community that couldn't donate, that maybe had never come to the theater before, underprivileged families, new Canadians, like so many people that we felt deserved to have a local theater. So the amazing news is, in less than 4 months, we reached 100% of our 2020 goal, and all of those initiatives are funded. So in those goals, we built into the budget not just the shows, which would hopefully be free, which now have been for more than 6 months, but also all of these other projects that we've always wanted to do that we felt were important not just to us, but in order to give back to the community and hopefully not even just limited to the Cape Breton Theatre community, but the Canadian canon of works, which certainly this project really speaks to. So we're over the moon. We've received so much support, and there's been such positive messaging from the community that all of these things are things that they want to see as well. And we've received attention nationally and internationally as well. We were written about in the New York Times as we were approaching our 100%, which is just, you know, a bit of a dream come true. And a few times, actually, in the Globe and Mail, including just before Christmas, this completely blew us away. But the Globe and Mail named us as one of their Canadian Arts Heroes for 2020, which was, like, yeah, pretty astonishing.
Yeah,
and not what any of us are expecting. So,
yeah,
anyway.
And I understand, I mean, speaking of recognition from outside the region, I understand that was reflected in the money that came in, too. It wasn't just people locally.
Absolutely, and that's, I think, one of the great successes. And the reason, again, that we've made sure that, most of our programming is locally based, there are opportunities for people elsewhere to see what we're doing. And again, this contest is part of that. All of our main stage productions we've done live streams of as well, so people from Alberta or the States or Italy can now get to watch half productions on their computer or phone. And that really did make such a difference. Honestly, when we started the Radical Access project, we were really counting on people who are already committed to the path, who come all the time, who are already paying for tickets, that basically, the hope was instead of buying their tickets, they would just change it to a charitable donation. Hopefully, they'd be able to pay the same amount or more. And as a result, they would get a tax-deductible receipt as if you're a charitable organization. So that was our first focus. What we didn't expect was just how many people from across the country and from the States and elsewhere who also bought into this idea and helped us to become the first Canadian community-funded professional theater. So that's been pretty amazing and certainly just so inspiring and really, I think, speaks to the local impact we've had, but then also the fact that these ideas are inspiring to other people as well. And hopefully we can set a trend that, honestly, I think could revolutionize how theater operates all around the world.
To your knowledge, has this radical access model been tried elsewhere, or is this sort of a new thing?
So it's definitely versions of it have been piloted, and there are two theater companies in particular in the States that we did quite a bit of examining as we were coming up with the concept. I've actually heard tell recently of other smaller companies in different parts of Canada who'd done either trial basis. There's actually a theater I've worked with, which I wasn't aware of at the time, but a theater in Barrie, Ontario, called Talk is Free Theater, after we announced, has also announced now that they will be also offering all of their programming for free as well. So it is starting to catch, and I'm sure there's other people that have done versions of this that we're not aware of. But through our knowledge and to the scale, I should say also, we are pretty sure we're the first, which is just really exciting.
And you expect to keep pursuing this model over time? Like, is there a sort of time window on when you want to maybe get more funds? Or because one would expect you need to do more some more fundraising if you want to get it going
That's definitely the question. I mean, the fact that we had such incredible success for our first year really blew us all out of the water. And I'm hoping as the year goes on, and especially hopefully as we approach more and more of a normal with the vaccine and hopefully more developments on that front, my absolute intention and goal is that we'll just be able to continue this and that everyone who's currently donating, people that donated as a one-time contribution last year, are coming to the shows and that they'll see, oh, this is working. This is more beneficial for everybody. And when we set out all of our goals, like I said, last June, it was basically a one-year period. So June to June, we said we'll do 12 shows. They'll be free. All of these other things are going to happen. And almost all of them are either in progress or have happened at this point, which is great. Probably mid-June, we'll announce our 2021 goals and our both in terms of projects and in terms of fundraising, because certainly we will need to make sure that people continue to contribute. And hopefully we'll have even some more exciting news by then that will up the ante even more in terms of what we're producing, what we're offering to the community, and all of the things we've started that we want to push even further.
Now, you did allude there to the proverbial elephant in the room with the COVID-19 pandemic. Maybe just say a little bit about how you've adapted as an organization during the pandemic and what you're planning to do, I guess, if hopefully the restrictions start to ease.
Absolutely. I mean, obviously for everybody, that has been the thing of the year, and it's not gone yet by any means. I mean, we've changed every aspect of how we conduct our business. And really, that was the instigator of how Radical Access came to be. Some of the ideas, we've been having free theater is something we talked about for the last 7 years, but actually having to reach a point where it was not only an interesting option or a cool idea, but it was really the only option became a result of COVID-19. Because we were allowed, I mean, we've been so lucky in Cape Breton, and I look at friends and relatives across the country, and they've been in lockdown now for some of them for 10 months, and it is just heartbreaking. So a lot of what we've been doing wouldn't be possible if the cases weren't so low, and if Nova Scotia and especially Cape Breton hadn't had so much luck in terms of keeping cases low. But even with that, obviously, there's all kinds of things that we knew we'd have to do if we were going to attempt any kind of production, which we have been. Most important, of course, is that audiences are staggeringly lower than normal. Our venue is a 400-seat venue. When we started in August having performances again, we had less than 50 people in a 400-seat venue. So that's grown a little bit based on when people book based on how big their group size is, but we're still operating, I would say at most around definitely less than a quarter of what we should be considering a full house. So that's part of the big challenge we faced was if we were going to offer programming, even if we had the maximum people we could fit, even if everybody paid twice as much as they were paying before, there's no way we would have been able to even break even because of the incredible expenses of the building and paying for the production. So it became this weird paradox where in order to make the necessary funds to make all of it work, we actually made it free. And I think that's something that I hope, again, and not even just in the theater industry, I hope all of us can consider where often we're so ingrained in the assumption of capitalism when in reality, while there's obviously lots of necessary strengths to capitalism, sometimes you have to kind of change your thinking, flip your assumptions, and certainly that's been successful for us. So that's the biggest change. Obviously, I mean, everyone's cleaning everything four times as often and using all kinds of new disinfectants and gels and everything else. But that's the biggest thing that continues to be an obstacle is the fact that we can only fit so many people with physical distancing. And again, hopefully, as the vaccine starts to work its way in the community, I mean, maybe by the end of this year, we'll be able to see those numbers go up. I really hope so. Because certainly it's not the same. It's not the same for the performers. It's not the same for the audience members. To me, the biggest thing that theater offers and the biggest advantage it has over Netflix, frankly, is the fact that you get to be one of a large group of strangers coming together for a shared experience. You get to witness the same story, which is unique to that moment with real people really in the room, and laugh and cry and sing, have these shared moments that, frankly, we don't really celebrate as a society anymore. I mean, these are things that are primordial. These are things that, you know, we would sit around fires in caves and do. And certainly even, you know, even something as simple as going to church used to be such a fundamental part of a collective experience. And sadly, that idea of communal gathering has just disintegrated over the past few decades. So to me, that's the huge advantage of theater. And obviously, any size of people that can gather is still a wonderful thing. And again, we're so lucky. To my knowledge, at least, we are the only theater in Nova Scotia that's been offering live performances since last March, and one of the few theaters in Canada that's been operating. So, you know, if we can do everything we've been doing with limited audiences, with masks, with all of the necessary safety and cleaning, we're so far ahead of the game, and we're so grateful for that opportunity. But hopefully, over the course of the year, we'll see some of that start to go a little bit back more towards normal.
That's our show for today. Thanks for listening. For The Coast 89.7, I'm Bill McCush.
Catch Dialogue 3 times weekly, Sundays at noon, Tuesday and Thursday at 10 p.m. Dialogue is a production of The Coast 89.7 News. For story suggestions, contact 902-849-9303 or email news@coastalradio.ca. For past episodes of Dialogue, check out our Dialogue podcast, available now online at coastalradio.ca.